Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are setting aside the titans of the High Renaissance, you know, the Michelangelos and the Leonardos, to look at the man who really carved the foundation upon which they built.
Absolutely. We're diving into the cornerstone of the entire movement, the Florentine sculptor Donatello.
Donato di Niccolò di Bettobardi, born around 1386. And our goal today, well, it's to synthesize the sources, look at his long and incredibly productive career, and really try to uncover the key innovations that made him such a foundational figure.
Exactly. What was it that allowed him to sort of drag Western art out of the Gothic era and launch it into this, well, this new world of classical ideas and expressive power? That's what we want to explore.
And it really was quite a journey. I mean, when you look at his output, the sheer versatility is just astonishing. He wasn't just stuck in one medium.
Not at all. Stone, bronze, wood, clay, stucco, wax. He even found incredibly inventive ways to use glass, which is pretty unusual for a sculptor.
Truly a pioneer across, well, pretty much every material available at the time.
And that versatility, combined with, I think, his singular achievement, the Bronze David, that's what really cemented his status.
Yes, the David. We'll definitely get into that. The first freestanding nude male sculpture since antiquity, right?
That's the one. It's like a visual manifesto. It perfectly encapsulates his vision, you know, blending that classical monumentality with a completely new kind of naturalistic expressiveness, radical for its time.
But behind this monumental genius, there's this fascinating contradiction in his personality, what we're calling the persona paradox.
Right. The sources describe him as, well, amiable, generally well-liked, even generous, not the sort of brooding, isolated artist you might imagine.
But on the other hand, he was apparently terrible at the business side of things.
Notoriously so. Constantly overcommitted, often incredibly late delivering commissions, sometimes just walking away, leaving works unfinished for years.
So how did he manage to be so fiercely innovative with that kind of chaos?
Patronage. Steady, incredibly powerful patronage. Especially, and this is key, from the Medici family as they were rising to power. They seem to have been remarkably tolerant of his, let's say, eccentricities and his lifestyle.
And that gave him the cushion he needed.
Exactly. The economic cushion required for his endless experimentation, even when he wasn't, you know, meeting deadlines.
Okay, so let's unpack his beginnings. Born around 1386 in Florence. His father, Niccolò di Bettobardi, was a wool stretcher. Now, that might sound a bit mundane to us.
But he wasn't. Not really. Being a wool stretcher meant he was part of the Arti della Lana, the powerful wool workers' guild. That actually gave the family significant status and presumably a decent income.
Right. And the name Bardi, any connection to the famous banking family?
It's important to note the connection was distant. He wasn't part of that Bardi banking dynasty. However, in Florence, even a distant connection mattered.
Especially later.
Especially after Contessina de Bardi married Cosimo de' Medici around 1415. You have to think, having that Bardi lineage, even distantly, probably didn't hurt Donatello's standing when he was looking for those big public commissions later on.
Okay, so not exactly rags to riches, but maybe a helpful connection. But before the spelting fame, his first appearance in the records is, well, less than promising.
Yes. January 1401, he's about 15. He's in Pistoia, and he gets formally accused of hitting a German guy with a stick and drawing blood.
Wow. Not quite the Renaissance man image we might expect.
A rather feisty start for the artist who would define grace and form. But it's right around this time, maybe even during that Pistoia trip, that things start to shift. It suggests that he struck up his close, lifelong friendship with Filippo Brunelleschi.
Brunelleschi, the architect, who was about 10 years older.
That's him. And almost as soon as they get back to Florence, they're potentially involved in something huge.
The 1401 Baptistery Door Competition.
It's exactly. The legendary contest that many see as the absolute starting gun for the Renaissance. The showdown between Ghiberti and Brunelleschi.
And Donatello, just a teenager, might have been involved.
It's plausible he assisted Brunelleschi with his trial piece. Imagine him absorbing those early ideas about perspective and classical form directly from his older friend, right at the crucible moment.
That's incredible context. But Ghiberti famously won that commission.
He did. And what's fascinating is what happens next. Donatello and Brunelleschi don't just hang around Florence feeling defeated.
No.
No, they pack up and head to Rome around 1402, 1403. And this wasn't just a holiday.
Right. You mentioned this was a serious intellectual pursuit.
Deeply serious. It was essentially an archaeological expedition that would change everything. They were systematically studying, measuring, digging up ancient Roman art and architecture, trying to unlock the secrets of classical proportion, monumentality.
Doing the groundwork, literally.
Literally. Much of ancient Rome was still buried then, and they supported themselves, the sources say, by working for Roman goldsmiths.
Goldsmithing. That sounds like important training for Donatello, especially for bronze work later.
Crucial training. Understanding metal casting, intricate detail work. It was a baptism by fire into ancient techniques, you could say. Brunelleschi took that knowledge towards architecture, the Duomo Dome.
While Donatello applied it to the human form, moving away from that stiff Gothic style.
Precisely. But before he fully launched his own career, there was one more, slightly ironic, step. An apprenticeship.
With Ghiberti, the guy who beat Brunelleschi.
Yep. From about 1404 to 1407, he's listed as being in Ghiberti's workshop, likely working on those very baptistry doors Ghiberti had won the commission for.
So he learned the prevailing style from the inside.
Learned it inside out. The international Gothic style, with all its detailed drapery and high polish, he mastered it, which makes his later deliberate move away from it, starting with his stone carving for the cathedral's Porta della Mandorla, even more significant. He knew the rules perfectly before he decided to break them.
Okay, so early 15th century Florence, a great time to be a sculptor, lots of public commissions, but also big challenges, right? These statues weren't for quiet contemplation in a gallery.
Exactly. They were for public squares, high up on buildings. Donatello had to figure out how to make these monumental figures communicate powerfully, clearly, to people looking up from way below, often at sharp angles.
His work for the Duomo, the Florence Cathedral, seems like the first big test of that, like the colossal seated St. John the Evangelist from around 1409, 1411.
Right. Destined for the old facade, placed high up the base, was about 3 meters off the ground.
So the big problem is distortion. If you just carve a perfectly proportioned statue, it'll look weird from down below.
Precisely. So Donatello had to adjust the composition. Make the head, the hands, maybe the upper torso slightly larger, anticipating how the perspective, the distance, would make them look visually correct once they were installed.
That sounds incredibly sophisticated. A real break from just carving what looks right up close.
It's a huge intellectual leap, rooted in classical ideas about optics and a humanist focus on visual reality, not just convention. And it's great that today in the museum, they often display these sculptures at something close to their original height, so you can really appreciate that foresight.
Then came the figures for Giotto's Campanile, the bell tower, starting around 1415, even bigger scale, same visual challenge.
8 life-size marble figures needed for these very high, narrow niches. Fine detail would be totally lost from street level. Donatello ended up doing 6 of them.
And among those is the famous Zucconi, Baldi.
That's the one. Probably representing Habakkuk or Jeremiah, carved between 1423 and 1425.
Mm.
Reportedly Donatello's personal favorite. Vasari tells that story about him swearing by it, by the faith I place in my Zucconi.
Which suggests how personal this move towards expressive realism was for him.
Absolutely. It wasn't just technical skill. It was about capturing inner life, character, even in figures destined to be seen from afar.
And speaking of challenges at height, there's that amazing story about the white colossus, Homo Magnus et Albus. Donatello and Brunelleschi working together again.
Yes, on this figure of Joshua, meant for the very highest parts of the cathedral. It's a perfect example of their practical engineering minds collaborating.
Because marble is just too heavy for that height.
Way too heavy. They didn't want the kind of structural problems Michelangelo later faced with his David. They needed something large but lightweight.
So what was their solution?
Radical. A core made of brick, covered with mottled clay or terracotta, and then the whole thing painted white. Innovative, cost-effective, surprisingly modern, really. It solved the problem and apparently stayed up there until the 18th century.
Incredible. Okay, moving from the cathedral to Orson Michel, the Guild Church. Here, the statues were lower down, right? About 3 meters up?
Yes, a different context, more visible detail, demanding a different kind of realism. His marble St. Mark for the Linen Weavers Guild from 1411-1413 is a prime example.
And this is where he uses that classical contrapposto pose.
Beautifully. For anyone listening, contrapposto is that counterpoise stance, weight on one leg, hips and shoulders tilting slightly. It makes the figure look relaxed, natural, alive, ready to move, a world away from rigid Gothic figures.
And we have to tell the Vasari story about this one. The guild members saw it on the ground first.
And hated it.
Yeah.
Complained it looked crude, unfinished.
So what did Donatello do?
Classic Donatello. He apparently convinced them to let him put it up in its niche, covered it, and promised to fix it over 2 weeks.
But he didn't actually change anything.
Nope. Just maybe polish the base a bit. Then he unveiled it in position, and suddenly, from the correct viewing angle, it looked powerful, sublime. They loved it. It just shows his deep understanding of how context and perspective transform the artwork.
Amazing. Then his St. George for the Armorer's Guild around 1415, 17, that had a different problem, a shallow niche.
Right. The space wasn't as deep. So Donatello, again, turning a limitation into an advantage, pushes the figure slightly forward, breaking the plane of the niche.
Creating what effect?
A sense of immediacy, alertness, and that anxious look people noted on his face, it wasn't accidental. It suggests Prontessa readiness, military alertness, very fitting for the Armorer's Guild. He's tailoring the psychology of the figure to its patrons.
Such smart choices. And then comes a big shift, the gilt bronze St. Louis of Toulouse around 1423-25. This is really the start of his major documented work in bronze, isn't it?
It marks a definite transition, moving from primarily stone to mastering metal on a large scale. And this piece was technically immense.
How so?
It was over life size, and it had to be constructed from separately cast and gilded sections. Fire gilding a whole figure that big would have been incredibly difficult, maybe impossible, certainly dangerous back then.
Which suggests?
It strongly suggests his collaboration with Michelozzo, who was skilled in metalwork and organization, was likely already underway by this point. He needed that kind of support for such a complex undertaking.
Okay, but before all these huge public commissions, there's that famous story again from Vasari about the wooden crucifix feud with Brunelleschi, the Santa Croce crucifix.
Yes, around 1407, 1408. Donatello carves this crucifix, and it's startlingly realistic. Christ is shown in agony, contracted body, mouth partly open.
Not the idealized divine figure people were used to.
Not at all. It was brutally honest. The image of a dying man. Donatello proudly shows it to Brunelleschi, who'd just come back steeped in Roman classicism.
And Brunelleschi was not impressed.
Scornful, apparently. Said it looked like a peasant on a cross, un contadino in Croce.
Ouch. And Donatello's response?
That famous line, take some wood and make one yourself. Basically daring him.
And Brunelleschi did. He carved his own, much more classical, idealized crucifix for Santa Maria Novella.
He did. And at the time, Brunelleschi's elegant version was probably seen as aesthetically superior.
Huh.
But Donatello's raw realism, that was a choice that pointed directly towards the intense emotional expression he'd explore much later in his career. It was prophetic, in a way.
So Donatello is not just mastering monumental sculpture. He's simultaneously revolutionizing relief work. He invents this technique called stiacciato.
Right. Literally flattened out. And this was a genuinely radical shift in technique. Think about Ghiberti. His old master Ghiberti used high relief, figures almost jumping out from the background.
But stiacciato is the opposite.
Completely. It's an incredibly shallow bas relief style. We're talking millimeters deep sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point was to create the illusion of depth using perspective, overlapping forms, subtle carving, not actual physical projection.
And the first big example is on the base of his St. George statue, the St. George freeing the princess relief.
Exactly. If you look closely at that piece, the figures are barely raised off the marble. But Donatello uses overlapping figures, and this clever partial perspective, you see that little arcade on the right, to create this convincing sense of deep space on an incredibly thin surface. It was like inventing a whole new visual language.
Wow. And he took this even further with his bronze work for the Siena Baptistery font, right? The Feast of Herod from 1423, 1427.
He did. And this one was designed to be seen up close, placed quite low down, near knee level for the viewer.
So even more demanding.
In a way, yes. The composition is masterful. He uses these three distinct receding planes, defined by architectural lines, to structure the scene. But here's where it gets really interesting, technically, and reveals Donatello's psychological genius.
How so?
It deliberately doesn't use a perfect single vanishing point, the kind Brunelleschi was theorizing about as the scientific standard for perspective.
Wait, so he's breaking the rules? Wasn't one-point perspective seen as the correct way?
It was becoming the standard, yes. But Donatello seems to be breaking the rules intentionally here. Art historians suggest that using multiple, slightly conflicting vanishing points creates this subtle spatial disharmony.
To what end?
To create a subliminal tension, an unease that perfectly mirrors the gruesome subject matter. You know, Herod recoiling in horror from John the Baptist's head.
Yeah.
Salome standing there almost nonchalantly. The skewed perspective adds to that psychological punch. It's not unskilled. It's deliberate emotional manipulation through technique.
That's fascinating. Using perspective for feeling, not just accuracy, he also used stiacciato for smaller pieces, right? Like Madonnas.
Yes, more intimate domestic works, like the Pazzi Madonna, or the Ascension with Christ, giving the keys to St. Peter. But as his fame and commissions exploded, so did his organizational problems. He was taking on too much.
Which leads us directly to that crucial partnership with Michelozzo.
The Michelozzo partnership, roughly 1425 to 1434, it seems like he was born out of pure necessity, but also a kind of complementary genius.
Donatello, the creative force, Michelozzo, the organizer.
Pretty much. Donatello was brilliant, but as we said, financially chaotic. Michelozzo was an architect, also a skilled bronze caster. But importantly, he was organized. He could manage the workshop, handle the finances, the complex logistics of these big projects.
And their collaboration produced some landmark works like the Tomb of Anna Pope John Tecchi III and the Florence Baptistry.
A hugely influential piece. It basically established the template for the grand Quattrocento wall tomb. It beautifully integrates Michelozzo's stone architecture and figures with Donatello's absolute masterpiece centerpiece, that stunning, realistic, recumbent bronze effigy of the Pope. All contained elegantly within a narrow vertical space. It was a new fusion of sculpture and architecture.
And they weren't just working in Florence, they took on projects elsewhere.
They did. Their workshop executed the Brancacci Monument for Naples. Though it seems Donatello's personal involvement was likely focused on the beautiful Assumption relief.
Hmm.
The work was actually done in Pisa and then shipped south. Shows the scale of their operation.
But the partnership didn't last forever. What caused the split?
It seems to have buckled under the strain of Donatello's infamous delays. The commission for the outdoor pulpit at Prato Cathedral, received in 1428, really stretched things thin.
This is the one with the dancing children reliefs.
That's the one. It was meant for displaying a famous relic, the Sacra Scintola, Mary's girdle. But the reliefs weren't actually delivered until 1438, a whole decade late.
So how did Michelozzo put up with that for nearly 9 years? The Medici might have provided a cushion, but surely Michelozzo needed paying.
Well, Michelozzo was probably compensated well for taking on the risk and the management burden. And the prestige of partnering with Donatello, securing these major commissions, likely made it worthwhile for a long time. But the Prato pulpit seems to have been the breaking point. It was just an organizational nightmare.
And the reliefs themselves, when they finally arrived, they were pretty radical too, weren't they?
Absolutely explosive. Described as a veritable bacchanalian dance of half-nude putti, pagan in spirit.
Pagan spirit on a cathedral pulpit.
Exactly. This wild, liberated energy, focusing on rhythmic movement, almost completely detached from traditional Christian themes. It stood in stark contrast to most religious art of the time. This shift in Donatello's style, this embrace of the untamed, probably also contributed to the partnership ending around 1434. Mm. He was just constantly pushing boundaries, regardless of deadlines or patron expectations.
Around this time, after the partnership ended, Donatello makes another trip to Rome. His second visit, the Rome Interlude.
Yes, around 1430 to 1433. This seems to have been primarily for more deep study of antiquity, perhaps solidifying his direction after branching out on his own again.
And did this trip influence his work?
Significantly. The marble relief tabernacle surround he created for St. Peter's basically defined the standard early Renaissance wall tabernacle type, integrating classical architectural motifs with these lovely child angels. It's also speculated this is when he might have met the great theorist Leon Battista Alberti. He likely returned to Florence with an even deeper understanding of classical proportion and form, which you see feeding directly into his next major phase, including the Bronze David.
Okay, so mid-1430s, Donatello's back from Rome, the partnership with Michelozzo is over, and he enters this incredible period focusing on sensuous bronzes, deeply connected with the Medici circle. And he seems particularly interested in finds of children.
Yes, putti, the classical winged infants, but also these figures he really championed, called spiritelli, sort of like imps or sprites.
Weren't putti already around in art?
They were. But Donatello gave them a totally new life and prominence. You see early examples on the cover he made for the Siena font back in 1429, these three little bronze spiritelli playing musical instruments. They're often called the first true freestanding figurines of the Renaissance.
Freestanding, like small independent sculptures.
Exactly. Not just part of a relief. It was a huge step, bridging classical motifs with contemporary forms and incredibly influential for later small bronzes.
And his most famous exploration of this youthful energy is probably the Cantoria, the singing gallery for Florence Cathedral from 1433-1438. This was a direct competition, wasn't it?
A head-to-head artistic duel with Luca della Robbia, who was creating a matching gallery for the other side of the choir.
And the pressure was on.
Intense pressure. Donatello's contract actually specified he'd get paid 20% more if his finished gallery was judged more beautiful than Della Robbia's.
Wow. So how did their approaches differ?
Completely different. Della Robbia produced these serene, beautifully ordered, classically restrained figures of choir boys and musicians. Very elegant, very controlled.
And Donatello.
With the absolute opposite way. His frieze is just bursting with energy. It's described as primarily symbols of Dionysiac abandon. These aren't well-behaved choir boys. They're wild, bacchic figures, almost frantic, dancing with this incredible rhythmic intensity. They seem to almost escape the architectural frame.
So one calm and classical, the other wild and pagan, side by side in the cathedral.
Exactly. It shows the amazing breadth of the early Renaissance that these two totally different, high-quality artistic visions could coexist. Donatello was deliberately rejecting serene idealism for something much more untamed, echoing that spirit we saw in the Prado reliefs.
This pagan, almost untamed energy seems to flow directly into another really strange and fascinating bronze figure, the Amor Attis from around 1440, 1442.
Ah, the Amor Attis. It's such a puzzle of a piece. It's a smallish bronze figure, but it has wings like Cupid, Amor, but also this Phrygian cap associated with Attis, a strange little tail, leggings that really emphasize his nudity and genitals, and he's standing on a snake.
What does it all mean?
Nobody's entirely sure. It blends classical references in a really unique, maybe even deliberately obscure way. Its artistic quality is so high that, despite Vasari mentioning it centuries later in the 17th century, people thought it was a genuine Roman antique.
So it perfectly embodies that blend of classical form and a new, maybe slightly unsettling sensuousness.
Precisely. It feels like a bridge between the playful Spiritelli and the complex sensuality of his next and most famous work.
The Bronze David, see 1434, 1440. We have to really stress the importance of this one.
Absolutely cannot overstate it. It's arguably the single most important sculpture of the entire early Quattrocento. The fact that it's the first known freestanding nude male sculpture made since the fall of Rome, conceived entirely in the round, not tied to a niche or a wall, that alone is history altering.
Nothing else really prepares you for it.
Nothing. It's this astonishing leap. That revival of the classical nude combined with this very particular, almost languid sensuality.
Okay, politically, David was a symbol for Florence, right? The underdog republic beating bigger enemies, like Milan.
That's the standard interpretation, yes. David is a symbol of Florentine civic virtue and liberty. But Donatello does something radical with the figure itself.
He doesn't look much like a biblical hero king.
Not at all. He transforms the king of Israel into something closer to a young, beautiful, almost androgynous Greek god. He's wearing only this rather jaunty hat and boots.
Which just emphasizes the nudity.
Exactly. And the eroticism isn't just general, it's quite specific and has drawn a lot of commentary.
You mean the detail with Goliath's helmet?
Yes. The gigantic feather from Goliath's helmet crest runs right up the inside of David's bare thigh. It's an incredibly deliberate, sensuous touch. Some see it as homoerotic, others as symbolizing luxury or pride being overcome, but it's undeniably charged. He's completely reinterpreting the subject through a classical, humanist, and perhaps personal lens.
And David, along with the Amor Attis, seems to connect with the contemporary gossip about Donatello's own life and workshop.
It certainly fuels that interpretation. There's a collection of anecdotes from the period, the Dedi Piacevoli, basically celebrity gossip that strongly suggests Donatello's homosexuality was pretty widely known, or at least rumored.
What kind of anecdotes?
Things about him hiring handsome assistants. And one story claims he used to stain them, maybe with makeup or dye, so that other patrons wouldn't find them attractive and try to poach them from his workshop.
Seriously.
That's the story. There's even slang used in one anecdote about a quarrel and then a reconciliation with an assistant that pretty clearly implies sexual activity.
But wasn't Florence quite strict about sodomy back then? Denunciations were common, right? Artists could get into serious trouble.
Extremely strict. Denunciations through the tambural boxes were frequent, and penalties could be severe, even death. Think of Botticelli later facing accusations. This is where the Medici connection becomes absolutely critical.
They protected him.
Seems very likely. Donatello's freedom to explore these unconventional, sensuous subjects and to live a lifestyle that was apparently commented upon was almost certainly enabled by the powerful shield of Medici patronage, particularly Cosimo de' Medici's support.
So their tolerance was invaluable, allowing his genius to flourish without facing the legal repercussions others might have.
Exactly. It meant that Donatello, despite being, by all accounts, terrible with money and organization, always had this powerful ally.
And his financial character really was something else.
Legendary. The classic story perfectly sums it up. He supposedly kept a bucket full of money hanging from the rafters in his workshop.
A bucket of money.
Yeah. And if his assistants or suppliers needed cash for materials or wages, they could just reach up and take what they needed. No bookkeeping, apparently.
That's incredible. Amiable and generous, but utterly unconcerned with finances.
His 1427 tax return confirms that his declared income was way lower than his competitor Ghiberti's, even though Donatello was arguably at the peak of his fame. He was clearly driven by the art, by experimentation, not by the bottom line. The Medici provided the safety net that let that revolutionary spirit thrive. So in 1443, Donatello makes a big move. He leaves Florence and heads north to Padua, where he stays for about 10 years.
Why Padua? What was the context there?
Padua was a prosperous city, part of the Venetian Republic's territory on the mainland. Importantly, it was politically friendly to the Medici back in Florence. It's quite possible Cosimo de' Medici encouraged or facilitated the move.
As a way to sort of export Florentine artistic prestige.
Exactly. Spread the influence. And Donatello's decade there was incredibly productive, dominated by huge monumental commissions. None more significant than the equestrian statue of Gattamelata.
The equestrian monument of Gattamelata, 1443-1453. This is another major landmark piece, isn't it?
A historical watershed, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the first life-size equestrian statue cast in bronze since antiquity. Think Roman emperors on horseback. Donatello revived that tradition.
And it became the model for countless later equestrian monuments across Europe.
Precisely. He'd clearly studied ancient examples like the famous bronze horses of St. Mark in nearby Venice and the Marcus Aurelius statue in Rome. You see those classical influences in the horse's powerful stance, the details of the rider's Roman-style armor.
Gattamelata himself was a condottiere, a mercenary captain named Erasmo da Narni.
That's right. Nicknamed Gattamelata, which means something like honeyed cat. But there's a bit of a mystery around the commission itself.
Oh.
His will, left by his heirs who commissioned the work, apparently only specified a very modest tomb inside the Basilica of St. Anthony il Santo in Padua.
But Donatello delivered this massive public monument outside the church.
Exactly. A grand statement in the piazza. The huge expense ended up being shared by the Venetian government and the family. It transformed what was meant to be a private memorial into a very public civic symbol of Venetian power and military leadership. Gattamelata is presented almost like an idealized Roman general, a Caesar.
So Donatello's presence alone in Padua must have had a huge impact.
Transformative. His being there, casting this huge bronze statue, spurred the development of a whole local school of bronze casting in Padua. He trained sculptors, founders. His influence directly led to Padua becoming a major center for those small, collectible table bronzes later in the century. He basically created an artistic ecosystem wherever he worked.
And while he was there, he wasn't just working on the Gattamelata. He also did a massive amount of work for the high altar inside Il Santo.
A huge project between 1446 and 1450. We're talking over 20 bronze reliefs, plus multiple life-size bronze figures.
Including the first life-size bronze crucifix designed to hang above the altar.
Yes, and the main altar composition itself was incredibly complex. A Madonna and child enthroned, surrounded by six saints. But the Madonna isn't just sitting there passively.
How is she portrayed?
She's shown in the act of rising from her throne. It adds this dynamic sense of movement, of presence, to the whole devotional group.
And the throne itself sounds elaborate.
Very. Packed with sophisticated classical details, sphinxes, symbols of knowledge, allegorical figures, and fascinatingly, on the back, a relief depicting the fall of man, Adam and Eve. It was this dense combination of classical learning, allegory, and Christian narrative. Plus, the 21 bronze reliefs telling stories, including the beautifully detailed scenes from the life of St. Anthony. A monumental achievement.
Okay, so after this incredibly productive, monumental decade in Padua, he eventually returns to Florence. And this is where we see a really dramatic shift in his style, right? Towards something much starker, more emotionally raw.
Yes. The late Florentine period shows a move towards a kind of intense, sometimes disturbing, expressive realism. It's quite a shock compared to the idealized beauty of, say, the Bronze David.
The prime example being the wooden penitent Magdalene.
Absolutely. That figure is just formidably expressive. For a long time, people thought it was very late, maybe from the mid-1450s after Padua. But some redating, based on his wooden St. John the Baptist from 1438, suggests the Magdalen might actually be earlier.
From before Padua, maybe around 1440, 1442.
It's possible, which makes the stylistic shift even more intriguing if he was capable of this kind of raw expression alongside the sensuous bronzes.
But regardless of the exact date, stylistically, it's a world away from classical ideals.
Completely. She's described as looking like a female figure. Her body is wasted, skeletal, hidden beneath this mass of long, stringy hair that acts as her only garment. All the focus is on her emaciated face, the sunken eyes, the open mouth conveying pure spiritual agony and penitence. Physical beauty is utterly rejected. It's all about the intensity of the soul's suffering.
It must have been profoundly shocking to Florentine's use to the sweet style he himself had helped establish earlier.
Deeply shocking, I imagine. And deeply moving. It shows him pushing into entirely new emotional territory.
And this trajectory towards raw, uncompromised emotion seems to culminate in his very last major project in Florence, the bronze pulpits for the Church of San Lorenzo.
Yes, the San Lorenzo pulpits, worked on in the 1460s, probably left slightly unfinished at his death. These are two large pulpits covered in bronze reliefs depicting scenes from Christ's passion and the events after his resurrection.
And stylistically, they are.
Extreme. You see incredible experimentation, almost abstraction sometimes. The spatial treatment varies wildly between panels. The scale of figures changes. There's a stylistic roughness, a messy, vigorous energy that feels almost desperate.
Described as showing the absolutely uncompromising use of every possible means to express emotion and suffering. It sounds almost painful to experience.
It can be. The figures are contorted. The compositions crowded and chaotic. There's a suggestion he was working with incredible speed and urgency, maybe even casting directly from roughly finished wax models, modelli. It seems his final artistic goal wasn't about polished beauty or classical harmony anymore, but about conveying the raw, immediate, overwhelming power of human suffering and divine drama.
We've talked about his mastery of stone, wood, bronze, but his innovation didn't stop there. He even experimented with glass, which seems unusual for a sculptor.
Highly unusual. But yes, around 1434, he was actually commissioned to design a stained glass window for Florence Cathedral. He also used little glass cubes, tesserae, sometimes set into the backgrounds of his reliefs, like on the Prato pulpit, for textural effect.
But his most inventive use of glass was the Cellini Madonna.
Ah, yes, the Cellini Madonna from around 1450. This is technically fascinating. It's a bronze roundel, the tondo, showing the Virgin and Child, but it's cast with remarkable precision so that it has exactly the same thickness all over.
Meaning the front relief matches the back indentation perfectly.
Exactly. The convex relief on the front has a perfectly matching concave hollow on the reverse side. And the idea was that this reverse side could function as a mold.
A mold for what?
For casting replicas in molten glass, or possibly cheaper materials like wax or plaster. He actually gave this bronze tondo to his doctor, Giovanni Cellini, in 1456, perhaps partly as payment. It shows this incredibly forward-thinking approach, almost like proto-industrial design, where the original artwork itself serves as a master mold for potential mass reproduction.
Amazing. Now, on a different note, what about portraiture? We have these incredibly realistic figures like the Zucconi or the Magdalene. Did he do many actual portraits?
It's a bit tricky. Aside from his very realistic tomb effigies, like the one for Antipope John the Decian III, verifiable portraits by Donatello are surprisingly scarce.
What about the famous terracotta bust of Niccolò da Uzzano? That looks incredibly realistic.
It does. It's dated to the 1430s and shows this really uncompromising realism, suggesting it might have been made from a life mask or even a death mask.
Right.
But modern scholars really debate the attribution. Some question if it's actually by Donatello. Some even question its quality, suggesting it might be later in the century.
So I'm certain, and the Gaudio Malata, that's not a real likeness?
Generally considered not. It's more of a stylized, idealized, Caesar-like head representing the idea of a commander rather than a specific portrait of Erasmo da Narni. It seems Donatello was more interested in capturing character, type, or an idealized form than literal individual fidelity in many cases.
Okay, so much of the story of Donatello, the anecdotes, the sense of his personality, comes down to us through Giorgio Vasari's Lives of the Artists, written about a century after his death.
Vasari is crucial, absolutely. He fully recognized Donatello's monumental importance and gave us so many of those memorable stories, the St. Mark unveiling trick, the bucket of money. They bring the artist to life.
But we need to read Vasari carefully.
Very carefully. Vasari, writing in the mid-16th century, had his own agenda. His book contains significant factual errors. Most notably, he got Donatello's birth year wrong by 17 years.
Why would he do that?
It artificially compressed the timeline of the early Renaissance, making the progression seem quicker and more Florentine-centric. Vasari saw Donatello as the essential starting point for Florence's artistic dominance, and he wanted to draw a clear, direct line of influence leading straight to his own ultimate hero, Michelangelo. So, Vasari is invaluable for the narrative, but not always reliable on the facts.
Got it. But inaccuracies aside, Donatello's actual influence was immense and undeniable.
Absolutely fundamental. His sheer variety, think of the range from the classical David to the expressive Magdalene, influenced basically all Florentine sculpture throughout the 15th century.
Yeah.
Everyone had to react to Donatello.
Even if they didn't always understand his later work.
Right. That late, incredibly bold, expressive style, the boldness of imagination and execution in the San Lorenzo pulpits that seemed to have been difficult for his immediate successors. Many of them reverted to a safer, sweeter style, a kind of refined classicism that, ironically, Donatello himself had helped create decades earlier.
But later artists picked up on it.
Yes, the next generation, the more progressive masters like Verrocchio, who taught Leonardo, and Antonio del Pollaiuolo, they clearly studied and absorbed the power and emotional intensity of Donatello's late work. They carried that challenging legacy forward.
And his influence spread geographically, too, because of his time away from Florence.
Definitely. His decade in Padua and time spent working for Siena earlier wasn't just a personal detour. It was like planting artistic seeds. By training local sculptors and bronze founders in those cities, he helped transform them into significant art centers in their own right. He effectively exported the Florentine Renaissance across Italy.
So it's really no surprise, then, that when Michelangelo comes to carve his own colossal David in 1501, he's not just making a statue.
No, he's absolutely making it in dialogue with Donatello. Michelangelo's David is both an ode to Donatello's achievement and a direct challenge to it. It confirms Donatello's enduring relevance, setting the benchmark for mastering the human form that all future artists would have to measure themselves against. #tagoutro.
So wrapping this up, we've journeyed through the incredibly long and varied career of Donato di Niccolò di Bettobardi, the master of pretty much every material imaginable, the pioneer who went back to Rome to rediscover classical forms, the genius inventor of stat shadow relief, and this complex character whose revolutionary art was protected by that crucial Medici shield.
He really was the ultimate artistic chameleon, wasn't he? Fearless in tackling political statements like the Gatta Malata, intimate devotional works, classical erotica like the David, sometimes all seemingly at the same time. His body of work is just this amazing study in contrast and relentless technical ambition.
And maybe that contrast is the real core insight here, the thing to take away. How could one single artist contain such radically different, almost contradictory artistic visions within one lifetime?
It's an amazing question.
You have the polished, sensuous, near-perfect beauty of the Bronze David on one side, and then on the other, the stark, suffering, almost painfully honest realism of the penitent Magdalene, or the raw, chaotic energy of those late San Lorenzo pulpits.
And perhaps that very versatility, that ability to pivot so completely from idealized classical beauty to brutally raw expression, driven by his own interests and his incredible technical skill, perhaps that's what truly defines the spirit of the Renaissance itself.
Calso.
It was an era obsessed with humanity, with man at the center. But maybe Donatello was the first artist who dared to show humanity in its full spectrum, the beautiful, the ideal, the sensual, but also the suffering, the flawed, the intensely agonizingly real, all of it.
A truly profound way to look at his legacy, a fantastic deep dive into the man who really launched it all. Thank you so much for sharing all that.
My pleasure. Always fascinating to talk about Donatello.